Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, you're going to be hearing more of my interview, which we began yesterday, with Michael Kopperman, the author of an interesting memoir called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. Michael Kopperman, straight out of college, became part of a program called Teach for America. The program dispatches to some of the poorest school districts across the country college graduates who have not necessarily received much, if any, in the way of formal training in education, but nevertheless have a passion for reaching out to disadvantaged youth. So Michael Kopperman was assigned to a very, very poor school district in the Delta region of the state of Mississippi. He changes the names of his students and even of the community to which he was assigned. In the book, he calls it Promise, Mississippi. I want to begin today's morning show by reading a little bit from the portion of the book called The Second Year, the subtitle of this chapter, Welcome to Success, in which Michael Kopperman describes his optimism as he is about to begin the second of his 2-year stint as a teacher of fourth grade students in this very, very poor rural black public school district in the southern part of Mississippi. Over the summer back in Oregon, I set out to learn how to teach. I immersed myself in education theory and methods of differentiation, consumed everything from Ellen Oliver Keene and Susan Zimmerman's Mosaic of Thought to Patricia Cunningham and Dorothy Paul's four-block system, and created a scaffolded curriculum synthesizing different theories and pedagogies. I set up an installation at my father's medical office with pictures of children and an essay about teaching in the Delta, and solicited donations of books, which poured in by the boxful. Then I read books geared toward best practices in creating a positive classroom culture and effective classroom management, and began to create systems and make signs and displays with poster board and Kinko prints. I convinced my mother, an architect skilled in interior design, to drive back to the Delta with me a week before school started and do a makeover of my classroom to make it into a colorful and inviting and functional space, and she generously agreed. We drove across the country with the Subaru packed to the ceiling and then unpacked what we had brought in the classroom, mostly boxes of books, and my mother clucked her tongue at the sloppy plainness of my room and unfurled her tape measure and sketch pad and found a vision and a plan while I swept and mopped and wiped away the dust and then began to order and mark the books according to grade level. The next day we drove to Rosewood to the nearest Lowe's for supplies, and we bought giant blue scraps of rug and great pieces of shower board and an interlocking series of folding shelves and paint trays for students to get new work and turn in old work and a hammer and nails. And then at the fabric store, we purchased bright fabric and twisty ties and wire and adhesive tape. And then at Walmart, we bought pillows and beanbags and dry eraser markers and magazine holders and notebooks in bulk and the biggest electric pencil sharpener available. And then we returned to the classroom and began to work, me, the grunt labor, and my mother orchestrating it all, as we nailed the great pieces of shower board over the fading slate of the chalkboard to form a huge whiteboard, and threw out the nubs of chalk and filled the ledges with dry eraser markers. We laid the thick blue rug and shaped the shelves, and my mother measured and bound the fabric into a series of blue and pink and yellow arcs to form drapes to frame each window. I ordered the books on the shelves, blue and yellow and white and black and green stickers to cover the distance between the second and sixth grade levels. And then I set up a line of work pickup and return trays for each student, set in each one a magazine holder with a notebook within for taking notes on the book each child was reading, and sharpened a pencil and tucked it in the wire of each notebook. We propped the pillows around the edges of the reading rug and put the bean bags in the corners, and my mother's considerable work was then done. And so I drove her to Memphis for an evening flight and drove back to return to work. I taped giant colorful letters for the word wall all the way around the classroom, and in the front above the board I secured the signs and displays I'd created concerning reading strategies that good readers apply, and decoding strategies for compound words, and picture modeling the listening learning position, and the list of three rules, the first being raise your hand before you speak, and the sheet bearing the class pledge I'd written right beside the American flag and the plaque put up in every classroom after 9/11, In God We Trust. And then I put up the colored card system for personal behavior, with black for superstar, and the list of consequences for being less than super, and mounted the special whiteboard meter for class recess time, and put up the morning math board on another piece of shower board on the wall beside my desk, with a new board for awesome work, and left the wall blank with expectation, and finally taped up the great glittery sign for the door that, just like the year before, said, Welcome to Success, but meant it anew. And I thought that now, for the second year, I was ready. The room was clean and bright and colorful, bountiful with comfort and color, and the insistence that here, in a classroom like this, only good things could happen. Anticipating the beginning of school, I posted a list on my door with the names of all the new children. I pored over their MCT scores, asked around about this student and that, no longer assuming that ignorance allowed unbiased judgment. My class was much higher achieving than the first year group, and smaller by some accident of enrollment, only 18 students to start. A gift. I read and repeated their names to myself over and over. Serenity and Felicia, Dante and Marvin, DeMichael and Deshaun, Precious and McQuavius, Latabanique and Solomon. I spoke their names as incantation, as a promise to keep, as I set my systems in place for behavior and morning math work and reading workshop and writer's workshop. The spell of preparation must have taken, because now what I recall is not the first minutes of the first day of class, the children seated at desks and excited and a little scared of their new Chinaman teacher being put through the paces of my first system. I kept a small silver bell by the front board, and whenever rung it required eyes up front and hands to desk and complete silence. I must have taught the bell and practiced it, gone over the classroom rules and the card behavior system and the recess minute meter, must have been nervous and focused, sleep-deprived, but wired. We must have gone over behavior in lines, over year-long goals, over the class motto. They must have been on their best behavior, though perhaps Felicia Jackson was already testing me a little with an out-of-turn comment or a slow compliance to sit up straight or keep her hands to the desk. All of that surely happened, but I cannot recall it. Instead, my only memory is of a morning during the first week, the children suddenly there in the rows of desks with raised name tags, faces all turned to the front of the room and feet tucked beneath chairs as I'd just rung the bell to signal the end to a work period. I asked a question about a math problem, waited as arms shot up, waving with waiting answers. Hope filled those early, expectant days of the new school year. Aspiration and excitement, and not enough time yet for the routine to take. Every morning was a new beginning. Children lined up outside my door, a still-asleep Felicia Jackson always there first, front and center, Solomon with his big eyes and quick grin, quiet, slight-shouldered Marvin a little away from the rest of the children, still sullen with sleep, leaning to the wall with arms crossed in front of him. Around the end of the hall past the room, half a head and shoulder evident past the corner, and as my footsteps echoed down the hall as I neared the door, a furtive peek from Serenity, and then a shy grin as she saw me and shuffled cautiously over to join the other children. She wanted only to come in and read, amazed and overjoyed at the scope and stock of the bookshelf, but already feared the other children who harassed her for being quiet and gentle and especially poor. As I neared the group, the children would go silent, hitting each other on the arm so they noticed and were ready, straightening collars and pulling on packs and standing back from the door so I could let them in. "Good morning," I'd call in my loudest, gladdest voice, an old Aikido trick of putting positive energy forth to carry the day. And Marvin would wince at the volume and Felicia narrow her eyes and mutter under her breath about how can't nobody know something gone be good before it start. And I'd throw open the door and the children would push through jostling, me calling out, "Slow down." Really, I wasn't any more patient than them. I wanted the day to flare and shine with imminence. In those early mornings of those early days of August and September, every dream seemed within reach. A portion of Michael Kopperman's memoir called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, published by University Press of Mississippi, in which he recounts the experience of teaching for 2 years at an exceptionally poor school district in the Delta region of the state of Mississippi. Particularly in the first of your 2 years teaching there, you were confronted with an especially challenging class. You had 24 fourth graders to teach, and you spell out just what a challenging group this was. And you also more than suggest, more than imply, that it was not completely an accident that you had been given such an exceptionally challenging group of students.
Well, and there is no way to go back and be certain that this wasn't simply a quirk or accident of enrollments. I don't think that my principal, who really was extremely supportive, was attempting to cause me any great harm. I do think that there's the possibility, in part because there had been a male Teach for America teacher in the elementary school the year before who was actually there with me my first year also. And he was very, very good with classroom management and with the children and with discipline and order. And so I think the idea was that I was supposed to be similarly talented because of my gender. And as it turned out, that was not the case. And I had a lot of very, very difficult young men in that particular class who had been previously identified as behavior problems. I simply didn't have control over the class for a great portion of my first months in the Delta.
Explain to our listeners your system that you started with, something called behavior bucks, with a sort of bank in the classroom. One of those ideas that maybe at a glance or on paper seems like it might just work, but was really hard to implement in real life. Explain what behavior bucks were.
I should have realized that capitalism was not going to be a victory. I had some idea. This perhaps came out of the institute that I had trained at, where the four of us teachers charged with teaching 4 hours all together each day with, you know, something like 10 or 12 students. And so, you know, I had come up with a behavior system in that group together that we had used, and I thought I would translate it into Mississippi. There are lots and lots of, as certainly elementary school educators will know, there are many different sorts of systems that you can use to reflect behavior back to children and help them help create a classroom culture which is effective and also sort of be positively influencing them, but also having there be consequences for bad behavior. My behavior bucks system, which was with artificially created currency with like dollars drawn on it and then colored in green marker, you know, led to runs on the bank very quickly. Every time I turned my back, I couldn't keep my eye on the chart. And so some children would apparently end up immensely rich, not necessarily through any, good behavior of their own, and other children would find that they had been robbed. The system was a disaster. And so I very quickly stopped recreating the wheel and implemented, you know, a more traditional behavior system with cards that signaled, you know, how a child had been behaving and that had either consequences or incentives built in.
One of the most difficult aspects of your story to take in is the presence of corporal punishment in this school. And, of course, there are all kinds of different ideas about the best way to render discipline. And there are, of course, some who thinks one should never lay a hand on a child under any circumstances. And then there are fairly moderate positions that say, well, sometimes there are those extreme situations where, yes, maybe sometimes at least something in a limited fashion might indeed be called for. You are in a situation where, at least the way it is described to us, corporal punishment crossed a line that most of us would find unthinkable. And the deliverer of that punishment was someone you call Assistant Principal Winston. I'm assuming that's not his name either. But explain to our listeners how Assistant Principal Winston operated and the kind of punishment that he was willing to deliver to students who were misbehaving seriously.
Well, and I mean, so, you know, this was an assistant administrator. I think perhaps he was out of his depth in ways beyond discipline. He had been, I believe, an athlete. You know, he was certainly something well over 6 feet tall. And he, corporal punishment and those issues are immensely complicated. when I was in the Delta, that was common, that corporal punishment would be administered to children. Today, we find that, you know, that even in the Delta, they've begun to phase out corporal punishment. I believe that it's an Amnesty International Human Rights Watch study of the United States that finds that really the only two areas that we're still using corporal punishment are Texas and the Mississippi Delta. We are directing those punishments principally against African-American children. And, you know, the application of the paddle, culturally appropriate or not, I did not find to be particularly justifiable or humane. You know, the paddle that Mr. Winston had was something well over 3 feet long, heavy, perforated so that it would whistle as it passed through the air. And, you know, he would swing it as like one would swing a baseball bat or a cricket bat with a snap of the wrist. I tended to find that 10 licks did little to improve the behavior of children, but did make me sick to my stomach. Mm. And, you know, I was raised in some ways, you know, being spanked. It's not as if I don't know many people and haven't had many people whose parents applied, you know, the switch or the hand. But I think that in the case of an institution using those sorts of consequences, that, you know, I don't think it's necessarily defensible.
One of the difficult quandaries that you found yourself in was that when really bad behavior would erupt in your class, behavior that you found yourself unable to control or subdue, that if you ended up sending a student to the office, you were in effect sending them to the receiving end of that paddle. That had to be an absolutely awful situation for you to find yourself in.
It was difficult, and it was difficult because I had to teach in the schools, and I needed something to do, right, when behavior reached a point that I simply couldn't sustain in the classroom. At the same time, you know, at some points in the course of teaching, I simply didn't send my children to the office. Now, I think to be fair, there were periods when Assistant Principal Winston had basically total control over the office. There was a time when my main administrator was out, who was not necessarily prone to paddling quite so much, and who tended to talk to children and deal with them, and who really had a lot of vision, so that the paddle was the last recourse. when it was going to be Assistant Principal Winston, there was a period when myself and some other teachers in the school, not just other Teach for America teachers, we would simply send children outside of our classroom to another classroom. We would sort of trade problem students to get them out of that environment. And that worked to some extent, perhaps not as well as a school that has, you know, a really effective sort of behavioral system and where administrators and teachers are well connected in ways that will necessarily help. But it was a challenge because because at some point you had to recognize that you were complicit in a system in which children were being routinely beaten. Do you participate in that system or justify sending children? You know, what exactly was your response? And at the time, I was simply in over my head. And so I think I did a whole mix of things. It's easy to look back and say, you know, that was wrong. And I think it's become increasingly clear to me that the system of corporal punishment, the institution of corporal punishment in public schools is wrong, that we can do better than that.
You write at one
but
point.
At the time, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was going to say, at one point you write, in describing one of these especially troubling scenes to you, you write, "I told myself that sending children to be paddled was a necessity, but somewhere buried, I knew it was indefensible." And that's, of course, the rub in which you found yourself, feeling like, at least in the moment, this was necessary, and yet this was indefensible. I mean, that's a terrible place for someone to find themselves.
It was definitely a bind. Of course, if I had managed my classroom better in some ways, I would have less children to send to the principal's office. and so, you know, some of those problems in some ways receded my second year because my classroom was not quite so chaotic.
I do want you to explain what I think is one of the most intriguing moments in the book. It is a moment with a young student that you really poured your heart and soul into, and yet someone whose behavior just became worse and worse, to the point finally where you eventually erupted in some physical discipline, not in striking him, I don't think. I think you describe it more as kind of a grabbing him and kind of throwing him. And you describe that this student's behavior finally changed, and for the better. And yet you found yourself so horrified by what you had done that you realized you just couldn't teach this young man anymore, and essentially sent him away to be taught someplace else. That seems like a really intriguing moment for you as someone who did not believe in laying a hand on a child, and yet when you found yourself driven to do so, actually saw it in a sense doing what you hoped it would do. And yet you just couldn't live with the results of that or live knowing that you had been driven to do that. That's a very complicated sort of emotional and mental knot to try to untie, isn't it?
I think the line that I write at the end of that of that chapter is that what he required, I couldn't afford to give. That young man was remains clear in my mind and was immensely difficult. He had come from very, very difficult circumstances, as I found out at some point. He was something like 12, 13 years old. In the fourth grade, but I had thought that he was the size of a 9-year-old, though acted in ways that weren't necessarily clear. You know, he had been a foster child of the state for many, many years and coming through that system, and he would also not tend to speak and would sort of not meet your eyes, talk to you. He was extremely oppositional. And I was, of course, in a classroom which was chaotic. I think in the day in question that I described there, where everything was coming to a head, you know, I had talked with his social workers. I had been told by my principal that they had realized that they should resource him because of how old he actually was now that they had discovered it. And resource is a way that in adults, unfortunately, often we deal with boys with poor behavior. Not necessarily, it's often not a matter of intelligence. And of course, the path that you're on once you're resourced for many, many children is not one in which you're likely to receive a real education. And so I didn't want to, you know, to allow my administrator to do what she had, you know, basically told me she could do at any time, which was to resource him. But realized, you know, in the course of a couple interactions and then a day in which I basically snapped, and lost my cool and completely in a way which I had been urged to do by many of the adults surrounding the young man. I realized that I couldn't try to, you know, to be physically punishing students or to dominate them, that was simply not all right for my sense of self and my own, you know, identity and sense of well-being, even if that was for this child what he required or what he would respond to, because it was the only, in the piece, right? Dominance was really the only system that he had ever known.
You're listening to my conversation with Michael Kopperman, the author of a book called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. This is a book which explores many of the frustrations and failures that Kopperman experienced in his 2 years teaching in this very poor school district. But there are also some success stories here, and one of them comes when he decides to offer an after-school class in the martial art of Aikido, something which he had studied since the age of 4, something in which both his father and mother were highly adept. In fact, he called his father back in Oregon and arranged for some special mats to be sent to that school in Promise, Mississippi, mats that would help make this Aikido class possible. Here is how Kopperman describes the first day of Aikido class. With trepidation, one Wednesday afternoon, I finished teaching and sent the kids who usually lingered in the classroom home early and took my G-bag to the boys' bathroom. I knew full well the appeal and authority of uniform, and the regalia of an Aikido shodan is considerable. Eventually, I stepped out of the bathroom and into the hall, and every child and adult I passed stopped in stunned silence. The samurai arrives in the Delta at long last, I thought, as I approached the gym. Behind me, I heard the office door open, and the secretary and Mrs. Washburn, another teacher on my hall, hurried out. Evidently, someone had told them to have a look. I waved at them and pushed the gym doors open. Inside were nearly 30 children, most of them boys. Their voices had been clamorous and still echoed, but most went silent as they saw me. One boy, late to notice, a fifth grader known for being difficult, had his back to me and was the last to stop talking. He finally turned, and his eyes went wide. "Ooh," he said with a mix of surprise and delight. I'd had a late free period when the gym was empty, and it had already laid out the colorful mats. "Please remain silent and make a straight line facing me," I said as I walked toward them. Jostling a little, they complied. One boy had his arms crossed, and I went to him and touched his elbow and said, "Arms at your side." And all along the lines, children thrust their arms down. A fifth grade girl, who towered above all the rest of the children and who had a habit of slouching, stood before me, her head hunched down, as was her habit. "Please stand up straight," I said, raising my own head and straightening my lower back, and the line complied. I stood before them, bent down and removed my shoes, and then arranged them by my feet with each toe parallel. "Please remove your shoes and then return to line." There was a quick shuffle and patter as shoes came off. I walked the line, corrected one pair that wasn't straight and one pair that was out of line, and soon the shoes were in a straight line and the students stood just behind. The children's eyes were bright with excitement and intrigue, and I stood before them and felt for the first time since I had been in the Delta that perhaps I did know how to teach something after all. I raised my hands to take in the bright squares of mat on the basketball court, the hoops and their sagging nets, the white halogens in their wire cages, and the overhead fan turning circles in the recesses of the vaulted ceiling. "Welcome to our dojo," I said. "Here you may call me Sensei." I'd like to say that I finally enchanted my children and transformed my classroom as easily as I commanded the attention of my Aikido students, but that wasn't what happened. Days weren't easy in November, a nightmare of frustration and chaos, or even in early January, when summer was impossibly distant. What changed was that I first lost Antiquarian and then Tevin, two of the boys who had been causing the worst problems. With them gone, though, I still had a difficult set of kids. I began to gain control of the class. Children could actually listen to lessons, and they stopped arguing consequences and started doing their work. I was able to joke, to ease up, and take them to recess without fear of what would happen, to loosen my tie and play a game of kickball on the grass field out back, or to stand and for a moment enjoy silence as the children stayed on task. Some days when everything went right and I stood at the front during Reader's Workshop and watched my students reading their books and writing in their journals, lips working silent syllables, a tongue in the corner of the mouth, the only sounds the tick of the wall clock and the occasional scratch of pencil to paper, and the light through the windows, golden and bright, limning the edges of upheld pages and desktops and the profiles of downturned faces, I would try to memorize it, afraid that I might never have such a moment again. And then a hand would rise, and I'd go to answer a question or help a student find a new book, grateful to be needed. An excerpt from Michael Kopperman's Teacher, 2 years in the Mississippi Delta. One of the most commendable things you do is that you seem very diligent in reaching out to the families of these students. I was going to say the parents of some of these students, but of course in many cases, probably most cases, both parents were not on hand. In many cases, one was maybe, and sometimes none of the parents were there. But this was important to you. What kind of difference do you think it made, the fact that you were reaching out, constantly calling parents, at least in the early going, reporting on the good and the bad, that was happening in the classroom, keeping this strong connection to their homes, to their families. What kind of difference did that make while you did that?
In retrospect, I perhaps needed to have communicated more clearly to the parents that I would be calling with attempting to make both positive and negative connections regarding their children. I think that it did help me have stronger relationships with many of the parents of the children that I taught. In some cases, having a teacher take an interest was, as some of them said, not something which they were used to necessarily. At the same time, in a few cases, where I wasn't actually reaching a parent, but where it became evident that I had called, I did some damage, meaning that, I had children get punished for my positive calls or my attempts at positive affirmation. think about that. I still wince. Mm-hmm. I was doing the best that I could. The children and their families, when I would actually get to meet with them, parents were immensely supportive of their kids and wanted the best for them. They maybe didn't always necessarily know how or what it was that my ideas of what I thought that that parents should do, those weren't always present, but in part that was about my ignorance of the community that I was in.
Hmm. One thing that surprised me was when you described these monthly workshops that would occur on the occasional weekend where you would be getting together with other young teachers, part of this program, for what you know should have been very positive kind of pep talk kind of experiences, that you often sometimes found yourself feeling very, very defeated in terms of the contrast between the reality you were confronting in your own classroom and sort of the bright message of hope that was being preached and the kind of testimony being given by others. In retrospect, what do you think would have been more meaningful and positive support for you, especially during that very difficult first year? What would have been, what kind of support would have made a better difference for you?
Well, and I think it is possible, though I would certainly forgive myself for this, that I was in part responsible for that disparity. Not because I should have been able to teach better in the classroom than I did or have struggled less, because I think that there was no real way that I was going to have done differently than I necessarily did, but I've had to go through what I did. But I didn't open up to any of the people, I think, who would have been glad to try to support me. And at the same time, I think that there was no malevolent intent on behalf of vastly more successful teachers who were in perhaps their second year or their third or fourth year, because many core members would stay when their schools passed, who were describing effective things that they had done and successes that they had had, things that they had learned. It was just that by comparison to my classroom, you know, felt that perhaps everyone else was soaring and I was being left behind. You know, of course, if we step back further and we realize that these are all very, very young professionals, right? It's not surprising that the public presentation of what it is you're doing is going to reflect the best possible version of yourself, and that perhaps by contrast, if you are feeling that you're floundering, that you might take away some discouragement from those sorts of sessions. You know, I think that today, I actually know a lot of the support staff, at least here in Mississippi. I actually just met with a number of them, and they were folks that I taught with many, many years ago, who have stayed here in some cases more than a decade. And I think that they have worked harder and harder to try to take into account the difficulties that people face. I think that it's very difficult to tell someone what it is that they should do. In some ways, teaching can be a very isolating profession. You know, when you're in a classroom, sometimes it is or feels as if it's only you. And so I think that they've worked to try to overcome that. But at the same time, I'm not sure what anyone could have necessarily told me or counseled me. I don't know if I would have listened.
I think one of the most surprising moments in the book is when you describe, in a sense, the hope that you would derive from just seeing those children day after day. You write, "The day before might have been awful. I may have yelled, broken chalk in frustration, put my fist to the wall as I did one day when I couldn't get even a moment of attention. But the children returned. They forgave. They arrived again at my door, waiting for me to teach them, to make good on the only promise I could keep, to stand at the front of the classroom and try. And so each day I began anew." I mean, for all the difficulties you experienced, at least you experienced that.
Well, which I think is a feeling that most teachers have, even if most of them don't struggle as much as I did my first year in the classroom. And that is to say that children are immensely forgiving. And also that there is a great promise to education, I think. When I picture those children now, and as I thought of them over the years, they have returned me and renewed me in every fall when I go to return to the classroom, as I will do here in, you know, a couple weeks. And I know that if I do my best, that I will get the best from most of them in return. I think that, you know, because education is often the and especially public education is the only institution in America that we really charge these days with realizing the opportunity and equality encoded in the American dream, I think that, that our classrooms matter, and they matter more all the time, in fact, in an America where economic disparities are increasing and widening, and where the amount of money that one is born into tends to dictate the both the education that one is going to receive in the course of one's life. I think that classrooms and teachers are the places where those exceptions happen, and they're the places where possibilities tend to happen. And even in even on my worst days, the children trusted in me, and that trust, I think, in some ways made me into an educator, even when my efforts were not necessarily the equal of the amount that they'd invested.
Let me finish out by reading to you a portion of one of the final chapters in the book, a chapter called Answers, from his memoir called Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. This is where Michael Kopperman is talking about some of the intense emotions and pressures which he experienced towards the end of that second year in Promise, Mississippi. As we neared the end of the year, the pressure to realize final results mounted for those of us who were Teach for America core members. I reluctantly participated in the push to do well on the Mississippi curriculum test, the nation and state and district and school-wide mandate to reach 100% proficiency in math, reading, and writing. We had rallies and visits from state officials and reverends who insisted that God would bless the test if the children kept Jesus in their hearts. We were told to dedicate an hour each afternoon to test-taking practice and strategy, and we were forced to administer mock Mississippi curriculum tests and assess our results and compare them. I refused to teach the test-taking strategy, but had no choice but to give the children the mock tests. "Man, shoot," Solomon exclaimed at recess after a morning dedicated to taking the full-length MCT practice test. "Seem like we gotta take a lot of tests just to take a test. Can't we just do it once?" I smiled, wished I could agree out loud. Yet I was afraid of what the children might repeat about how Mr. Cooperman didn't care about the tests and didn't make them go to computers to practice. Today, years after George W. Bush administration officials admitted that No Child Left Behind was a failure, and as the Barack Obama administration is in the late stages of deconstructing the dysfunctional policies that lingered in its aftermath, it seems obvious that such an extreme focus on testing and the practice of motivating administrators and teachers with the threat of punishment was wrongheaded and ineffective. On the ground in those early years, we were told that a refusal to buy in fully reflected either our own lack of professionalism or a lack of faith in our students' capacity to achieve despite their poverty and our school's lack of resources. I kept my mouth shut, but it was a tremendous relief when the 3 days of testing were finally done. A weight seemed to lift from the entire school. For those of us in Teach for America, frantic to meet our personal programmatic goals, however, pressure persisted. I was using a computer program to test reading level, a practice that now sounds absurdly imprecise, and a math diagnostic that was almost certainly not adequately varied or rigorous. Even so, as the results began to come in, I charted them frantically, aggregating and averaging, trying to figure out if I had in fact reached my big goal of significant achievement. Significant achievement, what a phrase. The idea that the focus was on what a teacher had done, that numbers on a page had any real relation to the long-term impact of such service. One late April afternoon, during Reader's Workshop, which had mounted now to 57 unbroken minutes of full-class focused reading, I found that the final numbers had come out all right. and that I had indeed achieved significant gains. I stood, felt a flush of joy and pride, and almost broke the silence and ended our month-long string of days increasing by at least a minute. I looked about the class, afternoon sunlight gold through the window, throwing hot white blocks of light to the floor and reading rug, and striking a silvery shimmer off the glitter I'd let the children use on the borders of their mounted biographies of famous African Americans. Solomon, who was flat on his stomach with his feet dangling beneath my desk, glanced at me standing over him, and then quickly returned his eyes to his book, while Marvin remained engrossed in his book beside him, their knees touching, reading each word in an almost audible whisper. I could see only Serenity's head and the top of her book visible from behind the big blue bean bag in the corner. DeMichael wrote a careful note in his book log with a smile on his face, another book finished and recorded and done with his tendency, which I'd fought all year, to value volume of books read over the book's reading level before he shuffled through his book basket for the next one. Looking at them, I let the easy sentiment wash over me. We did this together. And then, before I could even enjoy it, immediately the first pang of loss seized me. Soon I would leave, and I might never see these children again. I set the paper with its scores and statistics face down on my desk and left it there to resume book log conferences with the kids, knowing already how little such numbers mattered. The last day of school was difficult. Our end-of-the-year slideshow, shown to whooping applause in the final minutes, had us all tearing up. Marvin was especially inconsolable, huddled at the back corner for much of the afternoon. I tried to talk to him, but his stricken face was beyond consolation. "Why do all my teachers go away?" he finally said. "Yeah, Mr. C., why you gone on and leave us? Is it 'cause you don't like us?" Solomon piped up. I looked around the classroom. An agreement and accusation was there on Serenity's face and Deshaun's. Precious was nodding, too. I felt my throat seize. I didn't have an explanation. "I've told Willie all about our class, and he wants you when he's in the fourth grade," said Serenity. "My little brother, too," Precious said. "Who'll teach us Aikido next year in Delta Horizons?" asked Marvin. I turned my palms up as if the answer was in them. "Just tell me the truth, Mr. Copperman," Solomon said. His usual joking voice turned serious. "Is it that you have to leave, or do you just want to leave?" I turned away as my eyes teared up. Was I abandoning them? My place wasn't in the Delta. But how do you explain to a 10-year-old that you must leave him behind? I didn't explain, except to tell the kids that it wasn't them. Even now, I can't answer. The book again is Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, in which Michael Copperman recounts his experience of teaching for 2 years in one of the poorest public school districts in the entire country, located in the Delta region of the state of Mississippi. Michael Copperman now teaches at the University of Oregon, teaching writing to low-income, first-generation college students of diverse backgrounds, many of them emerging from disadvantaged backgrounds, such as those of the students that he taught in Promise, Mississippi. The book is published by University Press of Mississippi. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest on tomorrow's morning show is Ben Utecht, former NFL player who is now in retirement because of repeated concussions. And he has written a very poignant memoir called Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away, a love letter to my family. You'll hear from him tomorrow on The Morning Show.